The following program is being brought to you on the Voice America Business Channel. For more information about our network and to check our additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit voiceamericabusiness.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the following program are strictly those of the host or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management.
Are you interested in the cutting edge of investing? That means frontier and emerging markets. And would you like to get started? Or perhaps you are already investing but still have questions. Welcome to Emerging and Frontier Markets Investing with Gavin Graham. On today's program, we'll take a look at news, trends, and background information that you should know to become an informed investor in new and emerging opportunities. Now, here is your host, Gavin Graham.
Hello, it's Emerging and Frontier Market Investing, and I am your host, Gavin Graham, here each Wednesday morning at 9 a.m. Eastern, 6 a.m. Pacific, and 2 p.m. in the UK. Each week with my global roster of fund managers, analysts and journalists, both on the ground and in major financial centres, I look at emerging and frontier markets, try to clear up some of the misconceptions about these rapidly growing but volatile asset classes, and suggest courses of action for you, the listener. I spent most of my professional life analysing investments and hiring fund managers to handle large amounts of investors' money, and I figure I can spot the differences between promising investments and the not-so-promising ones. By emerging markets, we mean, of course, the BRIC countries, that's Brazil, Russia, India and China, along with such major emerging markets as Turkey, Chile, Mexico and the Czech Republic. And today we'll have a report on the effect of the continuing Russia-Ukraine crisis on equities in both Russia and around the former Soviet Union and the near-term outlook. By frontier markets, we generally mean the less developed emerging markets, but also some of the fairly wealthy states in the Persian Gulf and Middle East, countries like Colombia, Vietnam, Nigeria, Kenya, Bangladesh, Kazakhstan, Ghana, Panama, Slovenia, Qatar and the UAE. Today we'll have a report on the performance of several African stock exchanges and even a look at the possible impact of the Russia-Ukraine crisis on Africa as a major commodity producer. But now for the first segment, the story that continues to dominate many newscasts, the continuing crisis in Ukraine and its impact on Russia and Russian equities. Reuters reports that pro-Moscow separatists stormed government buildings yesterday in one of Ukraine's provincial capitals. That's Tuesday, April the 29th. They fired on police that were holed up in the police headquarters while smashing their way into the provincial government headquarters in Luhansk. Luhansk is situated in Ukraine's easternmost province with a large Russian-speaking element. It abuts the Russian border, and they're raising separatist flags over the building. The EU and the US have threatened further sanctions on Russia, but the effectiveness of sanctions remains open to question, both those that were imposed after the takeover of the Crimea and those which are now being applied. Yesterday, the European Union named another list of people who will face sanctions over the crisis, including high-ranking Russian officials, such as the Deputy Prime Minister and the military chief. The sanctions consist of asset freezes and travel bans and went into effect immediately. Where does all of this lead Russian equities, both as a major component of BRIC funds and elsewhere? We've had a regular contributor, James Beadle, who is a Russian expert based in Monaco but visits on a regular basis, on the program pretty regularly over the last couple of months to talk about it, and we have him here again to give us an update on the latest situation. Welcome back to the program, James.
I think it's very accurate. It's rather unfortunate, but what seems to be the concern of many international investors right now is that there seem to be some forces in Russia that really are not looking at the economics, or if they are looking at them, their priority is elsewhere. And so there seems to be a tendency on the Russian side to say that the economy is of secondary importance, which may have social logic to it, but for us as investors is very difficult to cope with.
Absolutely. And as you say, one of the most difficult things for investors to cope with is political uncertainty, simply because while one might be able to forecast earnings or even the growth of an economy with a reasonable degree of confidence, trying to guess what political actions will be and what direction they'll lead in is a very difficult game indeed. Does it appear that there's any end in sight to the escalation of the crisis, or that the sanctions having already been imposed appear to have had only a limited impact. President Putin has no intention of backing down. And as you say, there are elements within the Russian state that don't appear to be overly concerned about potential economic damage.
Unfortunately, there may be an end in sight. We're not sure yet. The problem is that so far the game plan for both sides seems to be continuing with an open-ended strategy. Obviously, the sanctions continue to be ratcheted up, and obviously the Russians don't seem to be paying any attention to them. What will happen on the horizon is towards the end of May, I think it's on the 25th, the Ukrainian temporary government will hold the elections to try to implement what everybody will view as a legitimate government. I think over the next sort of 3 to 4 weeks, we're going to see a lot of turmoil as the pro-Russian separatists try to agitate and disrupt the elections. And it's difficult to really be very positive until we see what happens when the elections come.
Yes, assuming that the elections are able to be carried out relatively successfully in the majority of the country, as you say, there would be a strong feeling, at least on the part of the EU and the US and its allies, that these are legitimate elections and any government resulting from them would be legitimate. But obviously, if it's impossible to carry out elections in the eastern part of the country due to the actions of separatists, that would give the opportunity for Russia and its supporters to say that the elections are not legitimate. Is that the game plan then, that's what it appears to be anyway?
Yeah, I mean, to be very honest with you, Gavin, we've been following this crisis together for a while now, and to start with, I was very positive and saying use the panic days, the crisis days, as opportunities to invest into assets. And if you've done that so far, you're still making money. However, it seems in sort of recent times, since they held talks in Geneva a couple of weeks ago, that really the situation is destabilizing. And I mean,
So as you said, James, if you had invested in Russian equities immediately after the big sell-off when Crimea was taken over, you're still ahead slightly. But obviously, the effect on Russian equities year to date has not been good, and it continues to appear to be a deterioration in the fundamentals, as we were discussing at the beginning of this piece. Russia is now apparently experiencing a recession. What's been the overall effect of the crisis on Russian equities?
Well, the Russian market is down about 20% year to date, which is obviously far worse than most of, if not all of its peers. I think Argentina is the only major market which is doing worse. The big concern really is whether or not the sanctions will become economic and start to target the whole sectors of the economy rather than just individuals. Because if the sanctions don't escalate like that, then these are still very cheap prices. But the concern obviously from an investor's standpoint is where is this crisis going to move, and trying to stay ahead of it is quite a challenge.
Indeed. I mean, as you were saying, when you get a big sell-off in a market that appears to have decent fundamentals and is cheaply valued, the word we all use is buying opportunity. However, when does a buying opportunity become quote-unquote catching a falling knife, to use another great stock market phrase? Is that where we are at the moment with Russia?
Well, I'm not. I don't think that it's so much of a falling knife, but there is a sort of concern that this will continue to drag out and maybe deteriorate somewhat further. So from my own perspective, I'm starting to be a bit more cautious, and I would want to see more panic tomorrow than I would have done yesterday before I start to buy. So I would still look for opportunities, but I'm being a lot more cautious about doing so.
So, as you say, the Russian market continues to look cheap, but cheap for a good reason. You mentioned the Geneva agreement a couple of weeks ago. Did that actually accomplish anything, or has what's happened since effectively meant that it's a dead letter now?
It would be a dead letter. It was a shame. It was such a good day. It really showed that there's no massive gap between any of the parties and that this could be resolved in 24 hours. And obviously, if it is resolved so quickly, then markets will jump back up very positively. But after the agreement was made, there seemed to be no clear implementation of any of the agreements. And so by now, I think that's a sort of lost cause, as it were. And we'll have to wait and see where the election path leads.
Indeed. And beginning to finish up here, James, what is the actual outlook for the Ukrainian election in those parts of the country where it's actually able to take place? Is that going to lead to a quote-unquote pro-Western government, as Russia has evidently been concerned about, in the sense that they might wish to become part of the EU or open negotiations for trade deals. There's been, what, a $15 billion support package for the Ukraine, for Ukraine, coming from the EU already, I believe.
Yes, I think sort of everybody's running and trying to do constructive things with Ukraine. And among the voters, obviously, the sort of central and western parts of the country will strongly vote in favor of pro-Western policies. And then the bigger question comes whether or not we can get the eastern parts of your country to engage in the elections and try to put their voice forward in a democratic process. Very difficult to see how it's going to play out at the moment, unfortunately.
Yeah. So therefore, to finish up here, James, your advice to investors looking at investing in Russia is, even though stocks are very cheap and we're down, as you mentioned, you know, between 15% and 20% year to date, it's still too early to step into the market yet. Once we actually get the Ukrainian election at the end of May, then things should be somewhat clearer.
Absolutely, and definitely can hand a shopping list of exporting companies. If the crisis continues to pull prices down even more dramatically than you expect, then maybe you can move in before then, but definitely with caution.
Okay, thanks very much indeed, James. Appreciate your insights on the developing situation. Sorry about the gremlins on the line.
Thank you very much, Gavin. Have a great show.
Thanks. Our thanks to Russian analyst James Beadle on the line from Monaco, with the occasional interference. I'm sure it has nothing to do with Russian countermeasures, but his view, as it has been for a large part of this developing crisis, has been that the uncertainty on the political side makes it too risky to step into the market. As he mentioned, after the Geneva Agreement a couple of weeks ago, it did look as though there was a possibility of there being a relatively peaceful settlement, but the most recent developments in the last few days seem to mean that that's now a dead letter. Just before we go to the break, if, like many investors, you wonder about China and what's happening with the slowdown in the economy there, we examine that in our new publication, the EFMI newsletter, The Ghost Cities, The Millions of Empty Residences, The Malinvestment by Well-Connected Companies, and The Shadow Banking System are all issues that we address in this new edition of our newsletter that's coming out this week. If you're interested, please write to info@emergingfrontier.ca or call 888-287-8229, and you can buy the newsletter immediately at our discounted price of $94.99 by going to www.emergingfrontier.ca/newsletter/buy. When we come back for the break, we'll be looking at Africa and seeing how markets in what some people have described as the new China and how they've been doing year to date. Please stay with us for that.
Think you've seen everything there is to see in online television? Let us surprise you. Visit voiceamerica.tv today for sports, health, business, and more on demand 24/7.
This program is produced by EFMI Media, which has become the leader in information about emerging and frontier markets investing. EFMI recently compiled the book entitled Investing in Frontier Markets: Opportunity, Risk, and Role in an Investment Portfolio, set for release by John Wiley & Sons later this year, and another book, also on frontier markets, which will be on store bookshelves later in the year. We are also launching a newsletter called EFMI. For more information, email info@emergingfrontier.ca. For more news about upcoming program segments, the books we have written, or the EFMI newsletter, please email info@emergingfrontier.ca. You can call 416-944-1750.
Have you had a chance to check out Voice America's online magazine and blog, Press Pass? If you love our hosts and shows, check out articles that give an even deeper perspective. Plus topics about health and fitness, movie reviews, philosophy, business tips and tactics, spirituality, positive thought, current events, and even more about your favorite host. It's just a click away at vapresspass.com. That's vapresspass.com. VA Press Pass by Voice America. All access, all the time.
From the boardroom to you, Voice America Business Network.
You are tuned into Emerging and Frontier Markets Investing with Gavin Graham. To connect with our program today, please call in to 1-866-472-5790. That's toll-free in North America, 1-866-472-5790. You may also send an email to info@emergingfrontier.ca. Now, back to the program.
Welcome back to Emerging and Frontier Markets Investing. I'm Gavin Graham. As I mentioned before going to the break, some people have described Africa as the new China, but that, of course, is to confuse a continent with a country, because Africa is comprised of many countries, a number of which have stock markets, and some of which have been doing very well so far this year, some of which have maybe been doing not so well. To talk about that, I have Thomas Mims on the line from New York. He's the founder and managing director of Emerging Africa Limited, which publishes news and data from 16 African markets on Bloomberg. He's also been a financial consultant in numerous African countries, including Nigeria, Ghana, Senegal, Sierra Leone, and others. Welcome to the program, Thomas.
Well, hey, thanks for having me, Gavin.
Great pleasure. Now, as I was mentioning in the intro, some African markets have been doing pretty well this year. Which ones have performed best year to date?
Well, of course, the year is young, but statistically best year-to-date would be, number one would be Rwanda, up 12.6%, then yep. Malawi, up 7.9%, and then Kenya, which really is a one of the major markets in Africa, yep. up 5.3%. I must say that Rwanda and Malawi are definitely what you call frontier markets. And the reason for the advance in Rwanda would mainly, I would say, would mainly be some IPOs. The Bank of Kigali, and then a major brewer. As yep. far as Malawi's concerned, I would attribute the advances to gains in the major companies that trade there: Yolovo, NBM, Nico, Nitel, PCC, Rio Sunbird, and TNM. As far as Kenya's concerned, it's up 5.3%. I think that's a continuation. I've attributed that to a continuation of the bull run. But I would have to note that Kenya's five-year return to date is 140%.
Thanks. Go ahead, please.
Yeah, by comparison, the top three markets in terms of five-year date, return to date, are Zimbabwe 160%, Kenya 140%, and Mauritius 122%. So the bottom three had great five-year returns also.
Mm-hmm. Now, I mean, those are very impressive numbers, and it's one of the reasons, I think, for people's enthusiasm about Africa as a place to invest. And as you say, there are obviously some pretty good individual country performances within that. Could you briefly enumerate some of the reasons that have been these returns have been so good? Has it been IPOs, which you mentioned for Rwanda? Has it been a greater acceptance of capitalism or better political governance that have been helping?
No, I would say that it's Africa is probably the last of the frontier markets or even emerging markets to be able to become recognized. But still, there's a lot way to go, and I would attribute that mostly to the fact that the African exchanges and also the issuers, I would say, are not as active as they should be at putting their show together and putting it on the road. Because I believe at this time, as far as the rest of the markets are concerned, frontier and emerging markets, that Africa is a place where there's a lot of slack to be taken up. Also, something to keep in mind is that there is a greater dependence on foreign investors. Africa has the characteristics of where the T-bill rates, local T-bill rates, are so extremely high that for local citizens, it just doesn't make sense to go in the stock market. If you can get 30% plus from treasuries, why are you going to invest in the market? On the other hand, that is offset by a very attractive aspect of the African markets that I don't think is that well known, and that is that foreign investors are exempt from any form of taxation, whether regards from capital gains or from distribution of dividends.
Right, so that's a major plus point for investors thinking of investing in African stock markets. But as you said, if you can get very high risk-free returns from local government T-bills or bond markets, it's hard to make the case that you ought to be investing in something that's regarded as being pretty volatile, at least, if not risky. Which markets in Africa maybe haven't done as well, both obviously year to date and then over the 5-year period, as you were mentioning?
Well, you know, the bottom three, which would be Zimbabwe, Kenya, and Mauritius, they had great 5-year returns. So these statistics of a year to date for 2014 can be a bit misleading. Because the bottom three really had tremendous 5 years. Kenya, for example, Zimbabwe 160%, Kenya 140%, Mauritius 122%. So, as I said, the year is still very young.
Indeed.
And we don't know what's going to happen. So I would say that that's a kind of a false start to draw any solid indications from from the bottom three at this point.
No, indeed. Sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, go on.
No, I was going to say the biggest market, obviously, in sub-Saharan Africa outside of South Africa is Nigeria. How has that been doing? And are there some encouraging signs there in terms of the longer-term outlook?
Well, Nigeria has just expanded their prospects, I would say, for the long-term outlook, in that they have a rapid settlement process there that has not been in effect until just now. And also, there has been a bit of a, what shall I say, in Nigeria, there's been a concentration for a while on IPOs that kind of took things a bit out of the true range of where the market really was, and then there's been some as far as adjusting to that, because there was an IPO fever in Nigeria that caused a perception by investors, particularly local investors, that this is going to be the same way for everything. So that's sorting out right now. And I would say that Nigeria will continue to sustain the growth it has over the past 5 or 6 years, but I'd say on a more even basis.
Right. So at the same time, one of the issues, and you mentioned in Nigeria had introduced a faster settlement system, lack of liquidity is often cited as a reason for people to be cautious about investing in African stock markets. Would you agree with that? And are there some improvements, as in the case of Nigeria, happening in other countries as well?
Yeah, I'd say there's a lower transaction cost there now. There's a better presentation of good transparency.
Yep.
And there's much better access to information and data. And I think that is creating a greater initiative for financial intermediaries to get involved there. The stock exchanges in Africa have grown significantly over the past decade. Between 1992 and 2002, the capitalization of African stock exchanges more than doubled from around $115 billion to $250 billion.
Right.
Then on to over a trillion presently. But as I mentioned before, the African issuers really need to put their show on the road.
Yes, sir.
Now that emerging markets account for more than one half of global foreign direct investment flows, and 60% of the multinational corporations expect to derive more than 20% of their total revenues in emerging markets, this suggests to me that a shift in global foreign direct investment flows is going to be a long-term development and not just a transitory phenomenon. But I think the African markets have to pick up the pace a little more as far as getting out the word. I think that historically what happened was that most of the African stock markets were created by colonials during a period of independence, created the markets, was in their best interest to create markets so that they could still have their finger in the cookie jar, so to speak. So therefore, there hadn't really been a culture established from the ground up.
Right.
So that's one thing to keep in mind. But also keep in mind that due to regionality, there are 16 stock markets in Africa per se, or 19, some say 19, but due to regionality, there's coverage of about 25 countries. So that means that there's over 25 countries in Africa with no capital markets.
Right.
So that kind of reflects on what I just said about the culture, the design and implementation of markets. Now, but one thing I must say is that the Nile Fund that's based here in the States,
yep.
The Nile Pan-African Fund by Lipper just a couple of weeks ago was rated as the number one emerging market fund on the planet. So
yes.
That's a good indicator for what's happening in Africa.
No, we actually, it was one of the funds that we looked at in our book on frontier markets. And mm-hmm. as you said, it's just been given the accolade for being the best performing, which obviously shows the potential. But as you said, with 25 countries with no stock markets yet, there's still a long way to go. So finishing up here, would you feel comfortable in saying to listeners that Africa is certainly something that should be on their investment radar screen, and that this might be a suitable time to start becoming familiar with some of the African countries?
Well, I've been saying that for the last over 20 years, so it wouldn't be anything different. But yeah, I agree with you, particularly now. Well, the non-correlation of Africa should be an attraction to global investors, because Africa, the non-correlation is very, very positive. What happened was the huge run-up that I just described in the market capitalization and the trading between yep. 2002 and 2008 was obliterated by what was happening in the world in 2008, the financial world, I should say. So at that time, everyone was looking at what's going on with the majors. It seemed like some type of collapse may have been imminent. So the extremely successful movement in the African capital markets to something was not recognized at that time. But the non-correlation still exists. And for one time, that's a good thing. When a non-correlation with Africa is a good thing. That's my answer to your question, or part of my answer.
No, absolutely, Thomas, and I think that's a very, very important point, the non-correlation, the fact that Africa doesn't move in line with the major markets while at the same time it has this great underlying potential in terms of growth is one of the features, a couple of the features that should make it very attractive to investors. So thank you very much indeed. That's lots of very good information, some fascinating statistics, and an excellent case for looking at Africa. I hope we'll be able to discuss this with you again in the not-too-distant future.
Yeah, one thing I'd like to discuss in the not-too-distant future, as you say, is the idea of global depository receipts being implemented in those countries that don't have capital markets. That would be a nice topic.
It would indeed. We'll look forward to being able to do that. I hope to speak to you again soon.
Okay.
Thanks very much.
Hey, thank you.
Bye. Our thanks to Thomas Mims at Emerging Africa, based out of New York, as Thomas was saying, and so lots of really interesting information there. But in essence, the size of African stock markets has quadrupled in the last decade. And one other point, of course, is the valuations are still pretty attractive. Now, but just before we go to break, we've talked on this program often about not characterizing an entire region on the basis of what's happening in one or two countries. It applies to Africa. It also applies to countries in the Middle East where the civil war in Syria continues, unrest in Egypt continues, but some Middle Eastern countries are quite safe and good investment destinations. We witnessed Qatar and the United Arab Emirates about to be promoted to the Emerging Market Index from the Frontier Market Index starting next month. We talk about one of those safe countries and whether or not it's a suitable investment destination in our new publication, the EFMI newsletter. For more information, please write to info@emergingfrontier.ca or call 888-287-8229. We're going to break, and when we come back, we'll be talking about more aspects of investing in Africa with Aubrey Fruby. Please stay with us for that.
From the boardroom to you, Voice America Business Network.
This program comes to you from the EFMI Media Company. EFMI Media is one of the most comprehensive sources of information and analysis on emerging and frontier markets. EFMI Media has become a leader in knowledge, expertise, and analysis of emerging and frontier markets, both in opportunities to investigate and pitfalls to avoid. For further information about EFMI Media, go to www.emergingfrontier.ca or call 416-944-1750. EFMI Media produces this program, researched and wrote Investing in Frontier Markets, Opportunity, Risk, and Role in an Investment Portfolio, which is set for release later this year, and is currently working on a second book, also on frontier markets. EFMI also publishes a newsletter called EFMI Information and provides knowledgeable speakers on these and other topics. For further information about EFMI Media, go to www.emergingfrontier.ca, write to info@emergingfrontier.ca, or call 416-944-1750.
From the boardroom to you, Voice America Business Network.
You are tuned into Emerging and Frontier Markets Investing with Gavin Graham. To connect with our program today, please call in to 1-866-472-5790. That's toll-free in North America, 1-866-472-5790. You may also send an email to info@emergingfrontier.ca. Now, back to the program.
Welcome back to Emerging and Frontier Markets Investing. I'm Gavin Graham. Before the break, we were talking with Thomas Mims about African stock markets and what's driving them. And for our first item in this program, we were talking about the political uncertainty as a result of what was going on in Ukraine and Russia. Obviously, one of the issues people have with investing in Africa is political uncertainty owing to government policy. And obviously, that's something that you as an investor or potential investor do need to take account of. However, there are reasons to feel perhaps a little more comfortable about the degree of government policy uncertainty. And to discuss that, I have Aubrey Hruby on the line from Washington, D.C. For 8 years ending in 2013, she was managing director of the Whitaker Group in Washington, a consulting firm for business in Africa. During those years, she spent about 70% of her time there, and now continues traveling there several times a year. She's been on the program several times, and we've had some interesting discussions on African markets and the longer-term potential. Welcome back to the program, Aubrey.
Thank you so much, Gavin. It's a pleasure.
Now, the political uncertainties that we were touching on vis-a-vis other markets obviously are a concern for investors when looking at what's happening in Africa. What kind of policy uncertainties are involved when you're thinking about investing in African countries?
Yes, yeah, so I think the most important thing is to realize that the policy uncertainty doesn't always have to do with political uncertainty in kind of political movements or elections or changing of regimes like it once did in Africa. Now we look at policy uncertainty in the context of just regulations changing in policies that affect certain sectors or the economy as a whole. So you really see two types. The first being policy uncertainty that affects the market as a whole, namely monetary policy, so things that affect inflation or deflation, forex controls like you see in Ethiopia, or currency devaluations that affect companies in the market across the board with varying degrees depending on the industry. And then the second type is more sector dependent. Things, you know, policies that have to do with electricity subsidies or mining royalty agreements or local content policies, labor policies that affect mining. So you have different sector dependent risks as well as these broader economic risks.
So let's look at first at inflation and deflation. Obviously, that's issues that companies in all countries around the world have to deal with, but presumably in rapidly developing economies such as African countries, there can be situations such as Zimbabwe where monetary policy goes completely haywire and you end up with hyperinflation. Is that a major worry, or is it only in the case of specific countries where there is, one has to say, a fairly mistaken approach to monetary policy?
Well, thankfully, monetary policy across the continent has been pretty stable. Zimbabwe obviously has been an outlier in that sense. But you do have inflation levels at double-digit rates in some countries. Overall, though, infecting portfolio investors has less of an impact because they are looking at the markets as a whole, and that risk is kind of factored in. However, certain industries are more exposed to those issues. So in a case of inflation, the consumer-facing goods industries often have more exposure to that versus extractives that are, you know, priced in U.S. dollars, more or less. So given the degree of inflation, and a portfolio investor may want to shift away from some of the consumer-facing you know, stocks and more into some of the safer extractive ones in a case of inflation. However, you're not really seeing that across the continent, again, because of the stability of monetary policy.
Well, that's obviously reassuring. And as you say, that it does affect different countries, companies in different ways, or different industries in different ways. Same thing, I presume, would generally be true for things such as foreign exchange controls.
Yes,
and obviously
indeed.
Different countries have different regulations.
And Forex in particular is used as almost like a monetary policy tool in some countries to really control the and prevent a dual economy of currencies running around. So you have local and then you have dollars trading. So Forex controls are used as a monetary policy tool in that sense. I think Ghana is an interesting case, not in terms of Forex, but in terms of a currency devaluation. The cedi last year lost about 19% of its value, which is quite staggering. And the companies across the board were affected by that. Those retailers who import, obviously were getting squeezed, and anyone who had, you know, labor contracts was seeing a benefit because they had to pay their Ghanaian staff less in dollar terms if they were selling internationally. But despite the 19% devaluation of the cedi, you did see the stock market return something near 45% in U.S. dollar terms. So despite the challenges, this macro challenges, you do see strong returns in the market.
And at the same time, as you have devaluations and currency controls, presumably that means it's virtually impossible to hedge the currency risk. You've simply got to be prepared to build that into your view of the country.
Yes.
And say that you're prepared to accept it.
Absolutely. On the continent, it's the rand is really the only currency you can effectively hedge. You're buying into that risk. I mean, part of the reason why you get the high returns is that there are high risks investing in some of these markets, and that's one of them. You do take on some of this currency risk.
Now, some other government regulations that could affect the way that various industries work would be to such things as local content requirements. Presumably, this is to ensure that it's not merely expensive foreign equipment being brought in and managed by foreigners, that in fact locals are hired, that there is a knock-on benefit, a multiplier effect in the local economy. Are some countries more stringent about that than others?
Yes. And it's also because extractive industries still dominate the stock exchanges in Africa. 23% of market capitalization in the African markets come from the extractive industries, and many economies are so dependent on the extractive industries that they seek to make the developmental impact of the industry more broad. And the uncertainty that exists around some of the local content policies quite large. Angola goes as far as making the oil and gas producers hold accounts in Angolan banks. Others have to do with hiring quotas. Some are quite ambitious. Ghana passed a local content policy that became law late last year, and so now they're in the phase of implementation. And there's a lot of uncertainty about the timelines. Will the international companies be able to meet the Ghanaian timelines? And if not, what happens? So companies are following the local content policies and the evolution of local content policies on the continent very closely.
So starting to finish up here, Aubrey, in terms of the way that you would access these markets, and I know this is a subject we touched on in previous conversations, given the relatively small, illiquid nature of many African markets, such things as foreign currency regulations, local content, would global multinationals or a well-diversified mutual fund be the way that most investors should start to approach investing in Africa?
Yes, because if they can't get into the small markets because of illiquid concerns, one of the ways to get in is to invest in companies that are growing on the continent, whether that be Walmart through Massmart or Coca-Cola or GE or IBM, or even if some of the mining companies that are listed on the London Stock Exchange, say London Mining or Tullo, the oil company, they're all building out exposure to African opportunities, and investors can gain access to those opportunities by investing in those companies or in Africa-focused funds. I know that you guys have featured Nile Capital several times, but that's one that folks can look at to gain exposure.
Excellent. Well, thanks very much indeed, Aubrey. We appreciate your insights into some of the uncertainties in Africa and perhaps some of the reasons why they may not be as major a stumbling block as some people believe them. I'm sure we'll be back discussing other potential interesting opportunities in the not-too-distant future.
Thank you, Gavin. It's always a pleasure.
Thank you. We have a break coming up, and after the break, we'll be looking at some of the other ways that one can play Africa with our African correspondent, Samuel Okoja. But when you look at some of the items in your bathroom, there's a sudden change of gear switch there. Many of them are produced by companies that also have a major exposure in emerging and frontier markets, such as Africa. And in our latest edition of the EFMI newsletter, we look at the third largest global consumer products company, which has over half of its revenues and earnings from the emerging and frontier markets and a major exposure to Africa. If you're interested, please write to info@emergingfrontier.ca or call 888-287-8229. You can also buy it immediately at our discounted price of $94.99 by going to www.emergingfrontier.ca/newsletter/buy. Please stay with us after the break for more news on Africa.
From the boardroom to you, Voice America Business Network.
Do you like what you hear about investing in emerging and frontier markets on this program? Would you like to learn more to increase your investing effectiveness? EFMI Media also publishes a subscription-based newsletter called EFMI. We'd like to tell you more about it. Drop us an email at info@emergingfrontier.ca. We've designed EFMI as a newsletter to provide expert and up-to-date news and analysis of opportunities in the same markets that we discuss here on Emerging and Frontier Markets Investing with Gavin Graham. EFMI has information and analysis that you won't find anywhere else, and you can start receiving it by emailing info@emergingfrontier.ca.
From the boardroom to you, Voice America Business Network.
You are tuned into Emerging and Frontier Markets Investing with Gavin Graham. To connect with our program today, please call in to 1-866-472-5790. That's toll-free in North America, 1-866-472-5790. You may also send an email to info@emergingfrontier.ca. Now, back to the program.
Welcome back to the final segment of Emerging and Frontier Markets Investing. I'm Gavin Graham. At the beginning of this program, we were talking to James Beadle, our Russian analyst, about the effects of the Russia-Ukraine crisis. And for the rest of the show, we've been looking at what's been happening in Africa. We're going to actually try and link those two situations together by speaking with our Africa correspondent, Samuel Okoja, from Lagos, Nigeria. What's happening in Africa as a result of the Russia-Ukraine crisis? Welcome back to Emerging and Frontier Markets Investing, Samuel.
Thank you so very much, Gavin. It's great to be here once again.
Thank you. Now, some countries in Africa are obviously importing from Russia and Ukraine, I presume primarily foodstuffs. How much effect has the Russia-Ukraine crisis had on African markets such as Nigeria and South Africa?
Well, as it is right now, the country that really comes to mind when it comes to direct effects of the Russian-Ukraine crisis is South Africa. Wheat futures in South Africa have shot to the highest level since 2008 on supply concerns because Russia and Ukraine are major producers of the grain. It's quite interesting to know that South Africa is the largest grower of wheat in sub-Saharan. South Africa imports 1.5 million tons of wheat annually. That's on top of the 2 million tons of wheat produced locally in South Africa. And so just a little background, Russia and Ukraine are South Africa's two largest suppliers of cereal, accounting for about 36% of all imports. And in Ukraine, the tension arising from their standoff with Russia means wheat and corn farmers can't go to their farms as they used to, you know, further heightening supply concerns.
So that's obviously a major effect, and I don't imagine many people knew that 36% of South Africa's imports of grains came from Russia and Ukraine, or in fact that South Africa was actually a grain importer, having been the breadbasket of the continent for many years. So what's happening in terms of the price of the loaf of bread in the supermarket? Are we seeing that yet in terms of price effects for the man in the street, or is it at the moment only further down the supply chain?
Well, to add a little more context, the demand for staple food in South Africa like bread is very, very high. You know, and that's one of the reasons South Africa imports grains from Ukraine and South Africa, in spite of being a major producer, you know, of grains. Now, already there are reports that price of staple foods such as bread is already increasing. If the situation gets worse, the impact will be felt by retailers who say they're already seeing the tick up in the price of flour. So eventually, consumers will pay even more for staples such as a loaf of bread. Almost 80% of South Africa's imports from Ukraine consist of cereals, mostly wheat. And so this could pose a risk should South Africa be forced to look to other more expensive providers like Canada.
Indeed. And obviously, this must make things slightly difficult politically for South Africa, given that it has links on the one hand with Russia and the Ukraine as part of the emerging market nation bloc, the BRICS, obviously. On the other hand, Europe and the US are important trade partners, I presume.
Absolutely. It's really putting South Africa in a very, very awkward position. You know, South Africa is a member of the BRICS, which consists of Russia and China, Brazil, you know, and India. And so South Africa is the only African country, you know, making up the BRICS. So an escalation of the crisis may lead to another Cold War between Russia and the West, making it difficult for South Africa to position itself. This is because South Africa, like I did say, on one hand, is part of BRICS, which aligns with Russia. But on the other hand, Europe and the US are also important trade partners of South Africa. So it's a very, very dicey situation. Also, if I may add, trade sanctions, if imposed on Russia, might also affect South Africa. Because eventually, since South Africa and Russia are major trade partners, some of this sanction might force South Africa to reconsider some of its position with the trade sanctions on Russia might force South Africa to reconsider some of its position in terms of trade with Russia in order not to, affect its, other trade relations with the U.S. and Europe, for example. So it's a pretty awkward situation for South Africa and other African countries who trade with Russia.
Absolutely. And some of the frontier market, less developed countries in Africa, do they have major trade relationships with Ukraine or with Russia?
Yes, absolutely. Interestingly, Tanzania and Mozambique have imported wheat from Ukraine. They import a significant portion of their wheat from that country. And so if the situation worsens, they will be forced to look at other sources, further, heightening the concerns about local price increases in staple foods.
So starting to finish up here, Samuel, is there any good news for African countries out of the potential trade sanctions and the rise in the price of commodities that's resulted from the Russia-Ukraine crisis? I remember we were discussing a few weeks ago the possibility of a BRIC development bank. Is that something that might be given an extra boost by what's been happening in Russia and Ukraine?
Absolutely, Gavin. Increased sanctions on Russia might renew the energy surrounding plans to form a BRICS development bank, which has been in the pipeline for some time now. And Africa may be a major player in the operation of the bank. Already, South African President Jacob Zuma has written to all other BRICS heads of states, indicating South Africa's wish to host the bank. This position has the full backing of the African Union. And so, if Africa hosts the BRICS Development Bank, it could help increase the integration of African economies into the largest emerging economies of the world, like China, Russia, Brazil, So it might also be some kind of good news for Africa, because as it is right now, Africa will be a major competing ground for development funds with the location of the bank in Africa.
So if the BRICS Development Bank were to get off the ground, when might it begin operations? Is there any timetable? Did President Zuma actually suggest when the BRICS Development Bank might begin operations?
Well, for now, they are supposed to have a meeting sometime, I think July, if I'm not mistaken. And it is hoped that the meeting will put some real shape to when the bank will get off the ground. But as it is right now, the momentum is becoming stronger and stronger. We might see the bank coming up on stream by the year 2015 if the momentum right now is sustained.
Well, that would certainly be a very interesting development. And as you say, it might actually help Africa in terms of getting development funds as opposed to the other major emerging markets. Thanks very much indeed for that, Samuel. Appreciate your look at the impact on the potential fallout from the Russia-Ukraine crisis on Africa.
Thanks for having me, Gavin.
A pleasure. So, as always, it's interesting to discover the ramifications of events in one part of the emerging markets and seeing where it might lead us. As I said to Samuel, I don't think perhaps many people knew how much grain South Africa was importing, and the fact that a third of it, more than a third of it, is coming from Russia and the Ukraine. So we've had a pretty African-centered edition today, but at the same time, there have been a number of threads leading out from that, whether it's major global multinational companies or the knock-on effect from what's happening in Ukraine and Russia. Next week, we'll be back with our global roster of contributors for another series of reports on emerging and frontier markets investing. In the meantime, if you're interested in finding out more about some of these issues, please have a look at our new newsletter, EFMI, the EFMI newsletter. Write to info@emergingfrontier.ca or call 888-287-8229. I'm Gavin Graham. Our producer is Al Emid. We are the co-authors of Investing in Frontier Markets and Frontier Markets for Dummies, both now available in English-speaking markets around the world and online through such major electronic retailers as Amazon.com. We're also the publishers of the EFMI newsletter that I mentioned. And this radio program, our books, and the newsletter mean we feel we're one of the leading sources of information about emerging and frontier markets investing. For more information, please write to info@emergingfrontier.ca. Again, that's info@emergingfrontier.ca. Thanks very much, and speak to you again next week.
Thanks for listening today to Emerging and Frontier Markets Investing with host Gavin Graham. Be sure to join us again next Wednesday at 6 a.m. Pacific Time, 9 a.m. Eastern Time on the Voice America Business Channel for another edition. Have a profitable week.